Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Chicago Board Options Exchange offers a handy index that's fun to keep an eye on. It tracks volatility in the markets, one of those measurements where a higher reading's not necessarily better. On a day when the Dow had its second biggest drop of the year, you know where we're going. The volatility index is high, up 20%, and investors, well, they're nervous. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with four top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's March 13th. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. Volatility doesn't simply happen, right? Just like your high school chemistry class, you need that certain combination of factors to create the right conditions. Things finally came together today in that capitalist experiment that is the New York Stock Exchange. Retail sales figures released this morning were weaker than expected. The inference there is that consumers aren't spending as much as they might. There was more bad news about the subprime mortgage markets. But the higher things are, the farther there is to fall. Diane Swonks, the chief economist at Mesirow Financial.
We're at lofty levels in the stock market, and with higher levels in the stock market, you tend to get more volatility. The 1990s was extremely volatile, yet the trend was probably too much upward through all of that volatility. So a return of a little volatility is well within the range of what you should expect. It was the lack of volatility that we had in recent years that was the atypical kind of market condition.
Technology was weak today as well. Hopes had been that sector would lead the way out of the slump. One of the biggest of tech companies was in the news today. Google bought YouTube last year for $1.5 billion. But the total cost to the search engine company for the site where people post video clips for the world to see could wind up being way higher. Google and YouTube have been sued for a cool $1 billion by the media conglomerate Viacom. The company's complaining about what it calls YouTube's brazen disregard for intellectual property law. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more on the continuing saga of internet upstarts and old line media.
You might think uploading video clips of your favorite TV shows would be the sincerest form of flattery. Not to Viacom. Today, the media giant went straight for civil court. It's suing and asking YouTube to yank 160,000 offending videos. Viacom says they've been viewed online 1.5 billion times. Gigi Sohn of the advocacy group Public Knowledge says, so much for the consumer.
By filing this lawsuit, Viacom is essentially spitting in the face of its customers and its fans.
Several other media companies angry over copyright issues have struck licensing deals with YouTube, and Viacom had been negotiating when it changed course and filed suit today. Dawn Shimoleski covers technology for the Los Angeles Times.
There's been gathering momentum and gathering unhappiness on the part of the content owners.
YouTube maintains it's impossible to filter out copyrighted materials as soon as they're posted to the site, but that it yanks them down as soon as someone complains. Public Knowledge's Gigi Sohn says the bigger issue here is rusty old copyright laws built for phonographs and books.
What we have here is a pre-VCR copyright law being applied to a post-YouTube world.
Until new laws are written, you can be sure lawyers for file-sharing sites and lawyers for content creators will keep duking it out. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
With so much entertainment available online, the computer might seem to be making the television less relevant. But a group of companies, including the likes of Google and Microsoft, want the federal government to approve a device that would make the internet available over your TV. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcasters aren't pleased about that.
The Washington Post reports that Microsoft has built a device that would provide the internet over the unused space between TV channels. The company worked with five other high-tech firms, Google, Intel, Hewlett-Packard, Dell, and Philips. Harold Feld is with the Media Access Project. He says internet over your TV would make Wi-Fi widely available in rural areas and more affordable in urban ones. But he says the high-tech companies aren't pushing for this out of the goodness of their hearts.
What they want is a pipe through which they can sell you services and devices that can take advantage of ubiquitous wireless broadband everywhere.
Telecom companies had to pay billions of dollars to access airwaves that provide wireless internet to laptops and cell phones. But TV white space, as it's called, could be unlicensed and free of charge. Consultant Gary Arlen says telecom companies are worried about competition.
That a powerful group of companies with big brand names that everybody knows can take their customers away from them.
Or at least force wireless providers to drastically drop their monthly rates. The broadcasters don't like the idea either. Robert Reaney represents broadcast companies before the Federal Communications Commission.
This would be a windfall to these technology companies who wouldn't be required to actually go out and buy the spectrum, just like many broadcasters and other wireless companies are required to do.
The FCC will test the device over the next several months and decide whether to allow it. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Britain might become the first country in the world to set hard and fast targets for tackling climate change. Under a bill unveiled today, the government commits itself to cutting carbon emissions by 60% by the middle of the century. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
For a prime minister who's planning to leave office soon and is searching for a positive legacy, today's announcement was a gift. Tony Blair was able to pose as an eco-pioneer.
Today, Britain becomes the first country in the world to agree legally binding targets for reducing carbon emissions reported on annually, which will allow us to set out clearly how we meet these ambitious goals.
The goals are ambitious. A 26% cut in Britain's greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 and a 60% reduction by the middle of the century. Environment Secretary David Miliband insists this will be possible as Britain develops into a low-carbon economy.
You'll see much more renewable energy. And in respect of transport, I think you'll see that the hybrid vehicles, the electric vehicles, are actually much more common, cutting carbon emissions further.
That's the vision, but energy experts say that to cut emissions by 60%, the Brits have to scrap all their domestic appliances, rip out their central heating, give up foreign holidays, and get rid of their cars. Ruth Lee of the Centre for Policy Studies says the new bill could be a disaster.
Many other countries will not follow suit. China won't, India won't, the United States probably won't. Our energy costs will probably go up relative to others. In other words, we'll lose economic competitiveness.
But Tony Blair said today climate change is the gravest threat facing the planet. He wants Britain to take the lead in tackling it, although he won't be around to pick up the economic pieces. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
29 of 30 Dow stocks lost ground today. Better than 95% of the S&P 500 was down at the bell. The sad music coming your way when we do the numbers. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was in need of some advice today about how to regulate American businesses. So he convened a special panel in Washington. He invited people like GE CEO Jeff Immelt and billionaire Warren Buffett to share their thoughts. And most of the guests had the same message, along the lines of what the secretary's thinking, that there are too many rules that cost companies too much to abide by. Pat Loeb has more.
Secretary Paulson was careful not to take a position on whether business has been overregulated since the Enron scandal, but he did ask rhetorically whether the U.S. should move toward what he called a principles-based regulatory system. In his words, we must rise above a rules-based mindset that asks, is this legal, and adopt a more principles-based approach that asks, is this right? Treasury Department official David Nason agrees.
In an overly rules-based society that the focus becomes too much on compliance and checking the box exercises as opposed to kind of principles and guidelines that guide correct behavior that everyone is striving towards.
Nason says reforms such as the Sarbanes-Oxley bill have worked, but the Treasury Department is willing to revisit some of them. Business leaders have been saying for months that overregulation is costing America money. They say fewer European companies want to jump through the hoops required to run operations here and to list their shares on U.S. markets. Billionaire Warren Buffett said though he feels like a teenager with Playboy when he reads financial statements, the amount businesses have to issue now is overwhelming. But consumer and investor groups argued that reforms were adopted because of scandals that defrauded thousands of Americans of their life savings. Amy Boris of the Council of Institutional Investors says she's not sure how principle-based regulation would work.
It sounds great, but we're a society where people want to know exactly what they have to do.
Boris says it's safer to spell out what is expected of business. I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Here with more on the business community's take on this story is our own Rico Galliano of the Marketplace Players. Now, Rico, you are not a businessman.
Well, Kai, I'm a humorist. And if you don't think humor is a business, just look at the grosses for Borat.
All right. What do you think of Secretary Paulson's suggestion?
Well, I'd like to focus on one in particular, this idea that legality is less important than doing what's right. Myself, and I think the rest of the business community, couldn't agree more. But we'd like to hear specifics.
Like what?
Well, for instance, Kai, my business is making people laugh, but lots of other people do that. David Sedaris, Jay Leno, to name a few. So it seems right that I should be able to have them deported.
Deport David Sedaris and Jay Leno?
Among others, yes. I'd start with my immediate competitors here at Marketplace, of course, Cash Peters, Sean Cole. Deport them to an island somewhere. Treat them well. Keep them fed, you know, but no communicating with the outside world, you guys.
But that's against the law.
Exactly. And that's the frustration. This is a brutal regulatory environment where I, as a businessman, am unable to do the right thing. Is Paulson willing to move beyond the so-called legality of deportation without trial in order to unleash my earning potential? And by extension, this economy's growth potential? That's what I and the business community want to know.
And I guess you'll be keeping a pretty close eye on the story?
You bet I will. And Sedaris, watch your back.
Rico is, of course, kidding, but just in case you think he's not, we ought to tell you his opinions are his and not ours. Turn out the lights. The party's all but over for the incandescent bulb. There's a conference tomorrow in Washington about how to turn the U.S. to more efficient lighting within 10 years. California lawmakers are considering a bill to change from incandescent bulbs to more energy-efficient fluorescents by 2012. Australia is going to beat that. It plans to phase out incandescents entirely by 2010. Commentator Tom McNichol says the trend's more about shifting consumer priorities than it is the power of technology.
In the 20th century, new technologies were all about convenience. If an invention made life easier, it was good. But here in the 21st century, consumers increasingly base their choices on survival, not convenience. Take the shift from incandescent to fluorescent light bulbs. Incandescent bulbs consume lots of electricity, but convert only about 5% of it into light. Now, Thomas Edison knew that when he developed the first practical incandescent bulb in 1879. It's just that in Edison's day, light bulbs beat gas lights. But now, with rising global warming fears, people are applying different standards to the same technology. Fluorescents give off a harsh, flickering light, but they use far less electricity than incandescents, and that means tons less greenhouse gases. So now, efficiency trumps brightness. Other technologies, like the gasoline engine and even computers with their high costs of waste disposal, may well fall victim to the same changing standards. Imagine an engine that runs on hydrogen or a much smaller computer that lasts three times longer. Outdoor barbecues and NASCAR races may soon be seen less as harmless pastimes and more like giant CO2 parties. But as they say, necessity is the mother of invention. General Electric recently announced it plans to introduce a new high-efficiency incandescent bulb by 2010, perhaps saving Edison's invention after all. Only one thing seems certain: what's going to continue to change is our perception of consumer convenience. After all, a bright, energy-wasting light bulb isn't all that convenient if it ends up leaving us all in the dark.
Tom McNichol's a senior editor at Business 2.0 magazine. You can send us your thoughts through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the 50-cent insurance policy with no pre-existing limits.
If they drink or don't, if they have diabetes or no, if they are old or young, if they are man or woman, if they smoke or don't, it just doesn't matter.
But first, let's do the numbers. The sell-off was pretty much across the board today, with the Dow Industrial spiraling down 242 points, just shy of 2%. Finally came to a stop at 12,075. The NASDAQ dropped 51 points, just over 2%, to close at 2,350. The S&P 500 shed 28 points, 2%, ending at 1,377. Every last one of the 88 financial stocks in the S&P 500 lost ground today, led by banks with exposure to the mortgage industry. Shares of Bear Stearns led the way, dropping more than 6.5%. Lehman Brothers lost close to 6%. Even General Motors was hit. The automaker stock lost more than 2.5%. Its former finance arm, GMAC, warned it's being pressured by the weakening mortgage market, so GM will be providing another $1 billion cash infusion. Bond prices rallied on equities losses. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 4.49% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on ways of moving health care toward universal coverage. A House subcommittee on energy and air quality examines climate change from the perspective of the auto industry. And is there anything you've ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask? Get answers tomorrow by participating in International Ask a Question Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As we alluded to up at the top of the program, another day today, another development in the subprime mortgage meltdown. The New York Stock Exchange suspended trading in New Century Financial today. That's the lender in the most trouble. Meanwhile, the Mortgage Bankers Association said today foreclosures shot up in the fourth quarter of last year, in large part because of those subprime borrowers. Marketplace's Tess Vigeland is here to explain why all of that matters for the larger housing market and the whole economy, too. Hi, Tess.
Hey, Kai.
Speaking of explanations, let's go over one more time exactly what the subprime market is.
Good idea. The subprime mortgage market is made up of borrowers who have had bad credit, little credit, or have no credit history at all. That means that any lender, like New Century, is taking on a huge amount of risk by giving them money to buy a home. Now, in addition to the borrower being risky, some of these borrowers are getting risky mortgages. For example, they'd get a teaser rate with a super low introductory interest rate for 1 or 2 years. And then after that, the interest rate skyrockets and the borrower is simply unable to pay. And that's what we mean by the subprime market.
Okay, so these people who are lending the money to these people with these subprime mortgages are now on the hook.
In part they are, but Wall Street bought up a lot of these subprime mortgages as securities. So investors are also on the hook. Wall Street has been trying to force the original lenders to take back some of those securities, but of course a lot of them are already in trouble, again, like New Century. So there's really nobody else to hold the bag, so to speak.
All right. So talk to me for a second about what this means for the housing market writ large. What does it mean for the, I guess it's called the prime mortgage market, right?
Yeah. For the prime mortgage borrower, it certainly could become a problem because lenders overall are tightening up on the credit that they hand out. So say you're a prime borrower, you have pretty good credit. You got an adjustable rate mortgage 3 years ago or 5 years ago that's set to readjust to a higher rate. So you were hoping to refi. Well, a lot of these banks and other lenders have tightened up on the credit, so you may find it's really hard to refinance. And you could be paying for the sins then of the subprime market. And certainly if you're a subprime borrower, it's going to get harder and harder to buy a home.
Let me make sure I understand. There is less money out there to go into the real estate market.
Well, that and it's they're putting more restrictions on what kind of people they will loan to.
Okay. Now, we have talked on this program many times about about how the housing market is in trouble, how we don't know where the bottom is. What does this mean for the larger economy if the housing market is yet deeper in trouble?
Well, as it gets harder to finance a house, if it does, and we're starting to see that it does, that means that there aren't as many buyers. So demand for homes goes down. Supply goes up. We already have lots of houses on the market because of the slump that we've been in. So you're just adding to the inventory that's already available. And the more inventory that's out there, the greater the possibility the prices will go down. Prices go down. People can't sell at the price they wanted to or thought they could. Buyers dry up because they can't get credit. And the slump just gets worse.
Any sign that this is going to happen tomorrow, or is it going to take a little while?
No, it'll take a little while to see whether this subprime problem infects the larger housing market and whether it infects the prime market. But it certainly is something that a lot of economists are watching very, very closely.
As are we. Marketplace's Tess Figlin. Thank you, Tess.
Thanks, Kai.
President Bush has been talking free trade during most of his swing through Latin America. He's in Mexico today for meetings with President Felipe Calderon, where the conversations turn to immigration reform, mending fences, not building them, and finding ways to make Mexican workers want to stay at home. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
President Calderon said last week he will quadruple the number of loans given to small businesses. The loans are tiny, $115 each on average, but they can help entrepreneurs start small stores, street stands, or workshops. 70% of jobs in Mexico City are in family-run businesses. Ahead of his visit, President Bush announced a similar small business loan initiative for the region.
Flourishing businesses provide jobs for people at home. They provide customers for U.S. products.
To me, those initiatives are more symbolism than substance.
That's Dan Griswold with the Cato Institute. He says microloans won't do much to free up a Mexican economy ossified by oligopolies and unions.
They haven't really fostered an entrepreneurial society with bottom-up grassroots growth. And I think the president's initiative is probably aimed at that. Really, there isn't that much we can do here in the United States other than keep our economy open to trade with Mexico.
George Grayson of the College of William and Mary says there are other problems. Red tape and government officials on the take.
You run the gauntlet of bureaucrats, many of whom have sticky fingers extended in your direction. That's not only a time-consuming process, it can be an extremely expensive and frustrating process.
President Calderon has convinced 220 towns and cities to start granting new business permits within 3 days. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Mexican insurance companies are getting into the microfinance market. There can be big money in those small loans. Even though the amounts are low, if you do enough deals, the profits can really add up. And Jordana Gustafson reports now from Puebla, Mexico. Micro insurance could be coming soon to a location near you.
Alfredo Hansberg is just not interested in the health of his estimated 6 million customers.
If they drink or don't, if they have diabetes or no, if they are old or young, it's no matter to us.
It's not that he doesn't care if they're sick.
This is not the type of product that requires that type of underwriting.
Hansberg is CEO of Seguros Azteca, one of a handful of new micro life insurance companies that caters to Mexico's working poor. Policies cost as little as 50 cents a week for a death benefit of $1,500. To get a policy, there's no medical evaluation and no extensive credit check. You just have to be between the ages of 18 and 65 and be able to prove that you have some income. Hansberg says life insurance for the poor is a product much needed by a vulnerable population.
The financial impact of a death in this population is much worse than in middle or higher income people.
The tiny life insurance policy proved a godsend for 40-year-old housewife Agustina Reyes Cantu. She received $9,000 when her husband, a bricklayer, died falling from a roof a year ago.
No, pues, me sirvió bastante.
The truth is, it helped me significantly. As I didn't have any other resources, when I found out about this, it helped me a lot.
The money has enabled Reyes Cantu to keep the house she rents, and it's paid the fees to keep her two youngest children, both teenagers, in school.
Micropolicies for the poor are not new, but usually they're attached to microloans. If the policyholder dies, the money goes directly to the bank to pay off the loan. The challenge to selling standalone policies is reaching the poor. Seguros Azteca has solved this problem. They've put branches in a chain of popular home furnishing stores.
The insurance market in Mexico doesn't have the best reputation, and our clients believe in us.
Seguros Azteca signs on an estimated 50,000 new policyholders a week. Eddie Baranoff isn't completely comfortable with this model for microinsurance.
In reality, the poor, they are so unsophisticated.
Baranoff is professor of insurance at Virginia Commonwealth University. She worries the poor could be taken advantage of.
They don't know anything about insurance. They don't know anything about risk sharing, underwriting standards.
Whenever you pool together a large group of people, like all those between the ages of 18 and 65, insurance rates are going to be much higher than they need to be, she says. 50 cents a week might sound like a good deal, but if you're a healthy 30-year-old, you could pay that amount for decades. If you're older and have the policy for just a few years before you die, the payout's the same. Still, Baranoff agrees that some insurance is better than none.
The good thing is that suddenly they're getting some kind of coverage in order to be able to develop. But when it comes to the rates, it's really questionable.
Along with Mexico, Seguros Azteca is gaining ground in other countries like El Salvador and Argentina, and soon, if all goes as planned, the United States. Hansberg hopes to offer micro-life insurance policies to migrant workers. There's one potential competitor Seguros Azteca may have to face down soon, though. Walmart expects to be operating bank branches in Mexico by the second half of this year. But is Hansberg concerned?
We welcome competition, but it will be tough for them.
In Puebla, Mexico, I'm Jordana Gustafson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, patients with advanced breast cancer now have a new option for treatment. The Food and Drug Administration approved GlaxoSmithKline's new pill today. It's called Tykerb, and it's meant for women with aggressive cancer that hasn't responded to another drug called Herceptin. Since it's a pill, theory is it'll be easier to administer than Herceptin, which is injected. It probably won't be any cheaper, though. Speculation is both drugs will cost about the same, $40,000 for 1 year's worth of treatment. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. It was deja vu all over again on Wall Street today. The Dow tanked 242 points, 1.9%. The Nasdaq lost 51 points. That works out to 2.1%. The S&P 500 fell 28 points, 2% there. Subprimes, nervous consumers, pick your reasons why on that one. Marketplace's producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, who owns church property?
The congregation may hold a deed to a church building, but the property is legally held in trust for all Episcopalians, past, present, and future.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.